The South China Sea is better left untouched. Nobody can afford to go to war.
South China Sea Code of Conduct discussed at ASEAN meeting in Manila. It's Tuesday, November 14th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, international students still studying in the U.S., India's capital dangerous for women. Shopping goes high-tech in China. Fewer child deaths. A look inside an ancient pyramid. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations reportedly will start negotiations with China on a code of conduct to ease maritime tensions in the South China Sea. A draft statement Monday at the 10-nation ASEAN summit in Manila said it is important to cooperate to maintain peace, stability, freedom of navigation in and over flights above the vital waterway to avoid miscalculations that could lead to escalation of tensions. Host Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte earlier suggested that despite differences, there should be no effort to confront China on the matter.
Today, China is the number one economic powerhouse, and we have to be friends. The other hotheads would like us to confront China and the rest of the world for so many issues. The South China Sea is better left untouched. Nobody can afford to go to war. Either the big powers, Russia, China, Britain, or the United States. It can ill afford a violent confrontation.
Mr. Duterte met with President Donald Trump Monday on the sidelines of the summit, and the matter of the controversial anti-drug crackdown underway in the Philippines did not come up. Rights groups have condemned the crackdown, which has officially left nearly 4,000 dead since last year, for allegedly employing extrajudicial killings. Asia Foundation analyst Stephen Rood, a visiting fellow at the Australian National University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty there remains general support for the crackdown among the Philippines' populace.
It is indeed, particularly in the cities, quite a vicious problem. So when asked if they approve of the president's war on drugs, they tend to say that they do indeed support it. However, there is growing concern about the fact that so many people are killed in the course of that war, and that concern has been growing. So in the end, if that's the only way that the drug war is being fought, it could undercut support for it.
Nearly 4,000, according to these media reports, have died since this drug crackdown began when Mr. Duterte took office a little more than a year ago.
4,000 is the number that the police count as having been killed in their operations, and there's an approximately equivalent number who've been killed in considerably more murky circumstances. So we are talking about thousands of people who have been killed, and the average Filipino would like to see anybody charged with such a crime face trial rather than being summarily slain.
Describe to me the importance of this ASEAN meeting in Manila for Mr. Duterte.
This is really the chance for President Duterte to come out in the international scene. I mean, he's been president for more than a year, but his performance at previous international meetings has been somewhat sporadic, missing dinners and skipping meetings and the like, whereas here he is the host for all the world's leaders and has a chance to demonstrate his more congenial side.
He's indicated that the South China Sea issue probably will not be discussed, better left untouched, in his words, even though President Donald Trump, who's now in Manila, has indicated he's prepared to mediate the situation.
In fact, there's a couple of different perspectives on this. The United States' clear objective is to ensure freedom of navigation and not to take any particular position on who owns those areas. Whereas what President Duterte is saying is he's not going to insist on answering the question of who owns the different islands and shoals and the like, as long as he is able to get both Philippine fishermen access to those waters and Chinese investment in the Philippines.
Earlier in Vietnam, Mr. Trump offered to mediate tensions in the South China Sea. After meeting with Mr. Duterte on Monday, the president praised ASEAN's 50-year dedication to building consensus on critical issues facing the Indo-Pacific region. These are among some of the top Asia stories that are trending on VOANews.com. Trump promises major statement following Asia trip. Regional leadership raises image of once erratic Philippine president. South Korea says North Korea wounds soldier as he defects. UN presses Asia-Pacific to support migrant worker rights and reform. Pakistan, Afghanistan report historic drop in polio cases. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also visit our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The United States hosted over 1 million international students for a second consecutive year. That's according to a new report that was released Monday. The 2017 Open Doors Report on International Education Exchange notes that in the 2016-2017 school year, the United States played host to a record 1.08 million international students. That marks an increase of 3% from last year. The report noted, however, that while the total number of international students in the United States increased, number of new students did not. VOA Asia's Ira Melman contacted Scott Stevens, the director of the English Language Institute at the University of Delaware. He asked Stevens why this is happening.
One of the important factors is the strength of the U.S. dollar. This has really hit hard for students coming from South America, Africa, Europe, and different parts of Southeast Asia, not necessarily China. And then you add to that some of the political unrest that there's been in Brazil, which impeached its president, and South Korea, which impeached its president, and Venezuela, which has sunk into some level of chaos, and that's impacted enrollments as well. And then also the Saudi Arabia had taken a pause, primarily, I think, initially with the decrease cost of the barrel of crude oil, which depressed markets throughout the Middle East. They'd taken a pause on their scholarship program and restructured it, and those students are starting to come back, but in slower numbers. And then I suppose one could add the Trump effect to it and the travel ban, which is maybe given some students a sense that they're less welcome here. I don't think that's true, but that might be some of the perception.
When it comes to the University of Delaware, I know that you have probably been speaking with students. Have they expressed to you any reluctance about the choice that they have made?
No, we were fortunate in that our particular intensive English program actually saw a 6% increase in enrollment, and our undergraduate enrollments increased as well by about 10%. And our students seem very happy here. I think a lot of what's going on is it may be that the numbers have started to level off, but I think students and their parents are beginning to shop quality, and I think they're looking for programs that universities that really support them, that make them feel a part of the campus, that promote their engagement with domestic students and other international students. And I think all those things have a factor. And if students feel they're getting real value for their tremendous investment in a U.S. higher education.
The proceeding has been an unpaid commercial announcement from the University of Delaware. But nevertheless, I mean, the number of foreign students, especially from China and other Asian nations and India, have proven a needed financial boom for a lot of universities. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think with particularly state support diminishing for so many U.S. universities, they're turning to where to make up those dollars. And part of the movement has been in the so-called public Ivies, where state universities are competing with other state universities to draw their students out of state so they can pay out-of-state tuition rate. And the other factor has been a real focus on international student recruitment. And, you know, international students tend to come over without scholarships, tend to pay full sticker price, and a lot of university presidents count on that to hold up their budgets.
Have you in any way changed your recruitment process in the wake of this?
We have redoubled our recruitment efforts, and we're trying to reach other countries because it's important for us to have diverse enrollment. And we're looking at things like opening up University of Delaware offices in China and in Korea. And I think it's really important for universities to have sort of an on-the-ground presence rather than come in, do an educational fair, and then leave. One of the difficult things is the opportunities like a domestic student has to come and see your campus and explore and to meet faculty. And international students have to sort of do this with much less information and much less firsthand experience. So having a continuous presence and more information and visiting faculty on a regular basis, I think, can help them and their parents make informed decisions.
What would you say to a prospective student and his or her parents about thoughts that might be deterring them from coming to study in the United States?
I would say to basically do your homework. Look at areas of the country that are, for example, safe. Look at the reputation of the universities, not just overall reputation, but with the particular major that the son or daughter is choosing to study, because a school may have an overall good reputation but not be as strong in a particular field. And then look at the level of support. Do you get to live on campus with other international students? Is there robust cultural programming to have international students meet American students? Is there a thorough orientation? Is there a pre-departure orientation in your country? Does that university take the time to reach out to you and involve the parents and communicate with the parents? You know, most students are very relational, and so trust your friends that have been to other schools and talk to them about their experience and whether or not they feel welcome and have a true sense of identity, and not just follow the headlines. You know, America is a big country, and there's a lot of places where students can go and thrive.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Scott Stevens, director of the English Language Institute at the University of Delaware, a university that hosts over 3,100 students from outside of the United States. Happening now in Asia, Bangladeshi fishermen have helped Rohingya Muslims trapped on a beach in Rakhine State to escape the violence in Myanmar, carrying them across the sea border in their boats. More than 600,000 refugees have fled into Bangladesh from Myanmar since late August. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us today. A recent survey assessing how well women are protected from sexual violence in the world's megacities found that London, Tokyo, and Paris seem to be the best places for women, while Cairo, Karachi, Kinshasa, New Delhi, and Sao Paulo are the worst. The Thomson Reuters Foundation study, published in October, was based on surveys with 380 experts on women's issues in 19 of the world's biggest megacities. In the case of New Delhi, the metropolis of 26 million people, a number of factors make it unsafe for women, as Rutil Joshi reports.
The Indian capital of Delhi has long been labeled a dangerous city, especially for women.
Delhi is particularly unsafe. I really wouldn't say that. But I think it is the fact that there is so much of reporting in Delhi, and also that there is so much of conversation around sexual harassment and sexual violence, different kinds of violence against women in Delhi.
These voices became especially loud following the brutal gang rape of a young woman inside a bus in December 2012. The rape of the young woman, who later died, shook the Indian capital and led to tougher laws. But Indian women say things have not changed that much.
If you're walking, you are like kind of a showpiece for everybody, because all the people around you will stare at you no matter what.
Stepping out in the night, one has to think twice. if you're on your own.
Nobody has any fear in Delhi. People think that whatever they do with women, this system will not be able to do anything. Delhi police themselves have asked for an 80,000 increase in their force for the past 10 years. It hasn't increased to this day.
According to India's National Crime Records Bureau, New Delhi saw a whopping 184% increase in cases of crime against women in 2016. This figure was the highest for any Indian city. Professional women like Drishti Day say they are on guard each time they leave the house.
Living in Delhi, girls are taught at a very young age that we must be home before 7. Or if we have to go to a party with friends, our brother can go, but we cannot. And if a girl does take that risk, and if something happens, then it is that girl's wrongdoing because she went alone.
While Delhi has a long way to go before it can be considered a safe city for women, experts say as more women enter the workforce, they will become a more visible and vocal part of the capital's life. And this will help change society's patriarchal mindset. Ritul Joshi for VOA News, New Delhi.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, government officials continue to struggle to deal with New Delhi's public health crisis as toxic smog, 10 times the recommended limit, envelops the city and surrounding areas. Schools have been closed and the use of vehicles restricted in an effort to help ease the pollution. Visit VOA 60 online and VOA Asia Facebook for top stories. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Flying drones are nothing new in the skies, but online retailers have been investing in them as a way to deliver goods faster and to those in hard-to-reach rural areas. But the automation doesn't stop there, Arash Arabasadi reports.
What once was science fiction is now a part of modern life. Flying drones are common these days, but they're increasingly proving their worth to online retailers and customers living in hard-to-reach areas.
My experience as a user has been very good. Because we live in the countryside, using a drone is very convenient and quick. It's very high-tech.
High-tech goes hand-in-hand with today's digital marketplace.
Technological and scientific progress will always lead to changes in the society, and the drone technology is only part of it. Our company wants to make contributions to the society, so we hope to cause less harm in the course of technological progress.
Automation at this workshop in Shanghai makes rapid growth possible for online retailer Best Inc.
Nowadays, it's hard to recruit a large number of people to do intensive manual work. If our business is to grow 50 to 60% a year, it's impossible to also increase manpower by the same percentage. Therefore, under these circumstances, I think technologies can improve efficiency in the long term.
So automation helps a retailer's output, but it's not without a human cost.
In the past, many positions were dependent on manpower. Now, because of modernization, after we implement automation, many positions have been replaced by machines. So in the future, it may become a problem for employment.
The future will likely mean fewer workers and more robots automating their jobs. But for now, at least, man and machine still need to work together as a team. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia, North Korea is holding an information technology exhibition in Pyongyang, showing off its latest IT products. Smartphones and computers are available to elite North Koreans, some with the ability to buy goods and services, and the North Korean intranet is a tightly controlled information environment. This story and more on VOA 60, also visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, over the past 25 years, the world has made remarkable progress in saving young children's lives. For the first time ever, child deaths have fallen below the 6 million mark globally. But VOA's Carol Pearson tells us that some of these deaths could be prevented, according to the latest report from the United Nations.
In 1990, 35,000 young children died every day. Last year, 15,000 children and babies died daily, a huge reduction that follows tremendous global effort.
The progress is very good and is continue, but it's not fast enough, and I need to stress these deaths can be prevented with the knowledge we have, scientific knowledge we have, with the tool interventions we have, with the resources that we have available. These deaths can be prevented.
And that's the tragedy. The latest UN report on child and infant mortality states that every year, millions of children under the age of 5 die, mostly from preventable causes such as malaria, pneumonia, and diarrhea. In almost half of the cases of child death, malnutrition plays a role. Health workers measure the arms of young children to determine how malnourished they are. Although more children are now living to their fifth birthday, the UN report says 46% of child deaths occur shortly after birth.
And those deaths in the first months of life, they are caused by preterm birth, so a baby that is born too soon. They are caused by low birth weight. They are caused significantly by sepsis, severe infection that is acquired during the delivery. And they are also caused by asphyxia.
A newborn might not be able to breathe if amniotic fluid isn't removed from the baby's mouth and nose. Children under 5 are also more likely to die from malaria than adults are, which is one reason children in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia have higher mortality rates than other parts of the world. But there are bright spots. Vaccines for yellow fever and now malaria are saving many children's lives. The problems are so immense. The UN says that despite these gains in reducing child mortality, some 60 million children under the age of 5 will die between now and 2030. Bustreo says most of these deaths are preventable. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
There was some exciting news out of Egypt, where the Scan Pyramid team made news last week when they announced the discovery of a void inside the Great Pyramid of Giza. VOA's Kevin Enix reports while the void may remain a mystery, the team's detailed map of the pyramid now allows visitors to roam its depths from anywhere in the world.
It's a view of the Great Pyramid precious few people have ever enjoyed, but it's one the engineers at Scan Pyramid hope will soon be routine.
Et là, on arrive grâce à cette technique à se téléporter.
Thanks to this technique, we can teleport ourselves to Egypt inside the pyramid with a group and a guide. With our setup, we can talk to each other in real time. What is new in virtual reality is from now on, you are not isolated. You're in a group, even with your family. And of course, you can go to places you couldn't reach in the real pyramid.
The VR tour was made possible by special imaging technology that allowed unprecedented views of the insides of the Great Pyramid. It could be the future for ancient sites. Visitors wearing VR goggles walk through the Great Pyramid with a guide, visiting places they could never go in real life.
Le projet Scan Pyramid sert certes à mieux connaître la
The Scan Pyramid's new technology helps us see through stone and know the pyramid better. The Pyramid project helped improve Muon tomography, and it may have applications in other fields.
The Scan Pyramid team uses muons instead of X-rays to look inside the pyramid. Muons can easily penetrate dense objects like stone pyramids, and this technology allowed the team to discover a never-before-seen void inside the Great Pyramid. The area, about 30 meters long, is inaccessible. Unfortunately, the void may remain a mystery. Despite its sturdiness, working in the pyramid is risky, and currently there aren't any plans to drill into the tomb to examine the void. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and if you happen to be in Thailand, you can hear us on the radio at Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University, also on U Radio of Hat Thai University, FM 101.25, Hat Thai University, both in Thailand. We thank everyone there who's listening today. You can also get in touch with us via Facebook at VOA Asia, or send us an email at voaasia@voanews.com. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what's going on in your part of the world. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Jimmy Cook, managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.